Hello, I'm Jane Crowther, Editor-in-Chief of Total Film, and welcome to Inside Total Film, the weekly podcast from the Smarter Movie Magazine. And today I'm joined by one of our contributing editors, James Mottram.
Hello.
Hello, James. Did you have a good Christmas? Did you watch loads of films and eat lots of Quality Street?
I didn't eat any Quality Street, shamefully. I did eat plenty of chocolate, just not Quality Street. I didn't watch loads of films. I went down the TV route. It's always my time of year to catch up with shows I haven't quite got to the end of. So that was my Christmas viewing, basically, was sort of going down a couple of different TV routes.
Okay, well, we will be talking this week about the big screen because we are talking Eyeliner and Elvis with Kaylee Spaney, Spooky Swimming Pools with Wyatt Russell and Kerry Condon, and Icy Conditions with J.A. Bayona. Plus, we're rating their films, Priscilla, Night Swim, Society of Snow, and the real-life story, One Life. So tell me, James, you've been doing small screen. What caught your eye over Christmas that you really enjoyed, apart from, obviously, the Strictly Come Dancing final, which I'm sure you watched?
I watched a small amount of the Strictly Come Dancing final. I avoided most of it. I've been trying all year to finish off The Bear season 2, and not because I didn't think it was great. It was just one of those shows that each episode is so intense. It's quite hard to sort of crash them all in a quick succession. And in a way, it was just one of those shows that kind of watched a little bit of it, then got distracted and watched something else, and then came back to it. And so finally got to watch the last two episodes with lots of good food close by, because I think you need good food before.
Oh, I think, yeah, that's essential, isn't it?
In The Bear.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Great.
Finally caught up with that. So that was great. If obviously won't spoil it, but if you haven't seen it yet, catch up with it. It's a brilliant show. Also, finally watched the last season of Snowfall, which is one of those shows that nobody really has seen, but is absolutely brilliant. That was its sixth season. It finished earlier in the year, but again, it took me a while to get around to it. It's this kind of story of crack cocaine in America in the 1980s. Stars British actor Damson Idris. Brilliant show. Highly recommend anyone. I think it's on iPlayer, so highly recommend anyone who fancies.
I have to admit,
kind of
I have never
dramatic
heard of it.
Yeah, it is one of those shows that it just kind of didn't really catch fire. I think it's more well known in America, but it's John Singleton, who obviously passed away during the life cycle of the show. He was sort of very much instrumental in creating it. And it's, as I say, Damson Idris and Carter Hudson, who's an absolutely brilliant actor, who, again, doesn't seem to have done a great deal else that I'm aware of, but is brilliant in the show. So highly recommend people getting into Snowfall if they fancy something quite intense, which it really is.
Okay.
And what did you catch up on over Christmas?
Well, I finished off my Tom Cruise cake. We got two. I know other publications have been banging on about their two cakes and saying, oh, other outlets only got one. Lies. We all got two. We had two, so we had a lot to eat. So we've eaten our Tom Cruise cake. The end of it was a little bit dry, I have to admit, because we'd kept it that long. But I'm still enjoying it. It's still the thing that makes me happiest at Christmas when that Tom Cruise cake comes. So that's what I was doing. And I watched The Bodyguard last night because it was on. Yeah. I'd forgotten how sort of uncomfortable it is.
I mean, you love Kevin, obviously.
I love Kevin, and I do think he's incredibly charismatic in it, and she's, like, you know, got the pipes. But it kind of, it is one of those ones that I know they keep talking about remaking it. I would like to see it remade with a little more sizzling chemistry between the two leads and some real understanding of fame and social and all of that sort of thing that isn't included in that, obviously, because of the time it was made. So that's what I'm looking for. That's on my wish list, Santa, for next year. Could someone start production on The Bodyguard update? I have to think about who I'd cast in that. Who would you go?
Well, I was going to ask, who would play the Whitney role?
I know. Taylor?
Well, Taylor Swift. What about, I don't know, Dua Lipa, maybe? Or maybe she's not quite right. Beyonce?
I mean, yes, please. That would be lovely. Beyonce, put a call in, James. Anyway, shall we move on? And we haven't obviously been up to much this week because we literally have just crawled out of bed and we've started work on our next issue. But in the words of Paul Simon, we're now going to Graceland.
Hi. What's your name?
Priscilla Boyer.
You like Elvis Presley?
Of course. Who doesn't?
What are the kids listening to these days?
Bobby Darin, Fabian, and you.
Just what is the intent here, Mr. Presley? You got women throwing themselves at you. Why my daughter?
Well, sir, I happen to be very fond of your daughter.
So this is Priscilla, the flip side to Baz Luhrmann's Elvis, and this tracks the courtship and marriage of the Presleys from the point of view of Priscilla. Before we talk about the film, let's hear what the star of the film, Kaylee Spaney, had to say about stepping into Scylla's kitten heel shoes when she talked to Emily Garber about it.
Was there something you're hiding?
I don't have a goddamn thing to hide.
I need a woman who understands that things like this might happen. Are you going to be here or not?
You're amazing as Priscilla, and I read that Kirsten Dunst put a good word in for you to help you get the role, which must be kind of the highest form of praise you can get for a Sofia Coppola movie.
It's the best way to enter a Sofia Coppola film, I think, ever, is for like a passing of the torch from Sofia Coppola's muse herself. So yeah, pretty amazing.
Yeah, for sure. What was it like working with Sofia? What's she like as a director?
I mean, I couldn't think of anyone better to tell the story because she leans so much into the fashion and the beauty and the backdrop of Graceland and 60s Americana. And it feels like you're always in Priscilla's point of view. And, you know, for an actor to be able to be in that sort of immersive environment, you know, our set designer Tamara Deverell did such a beautiful job in it, and really leaning into the colors and the sort of Alice in Wonderland type dream world that we get whisked into after leaving Germany, and the way that our cinematographer Philippe Delasorde also used light, and the way that we sort of change moods through colors and lighting as we follow Priscilla's journey, I think is really special, because I think we tell it in this sort of impressionistic memory type way that sort of flips the biopic on its head, I feel like, and especially because we have to span so much time. You know, I play from her life from 14 to 28. To sort of follow the story and this journey in that way feels like you've just completely stepped into this world, and you can feel the fabrics and you can smell the room almost, and you're right there. She's putting her makeup on, I think is such a beautiful way to tell the story.
Interesting what you said about memory, because there's some interesting kind of omissions, I guess, in the film, like some of the more visceral parts. You know, we see Priscilla go into labor, but we don't see the birth of Lisa Marie, and, you know, we don't see kind of any sex scenes. So and that creates almost like a detached feel, I felt. So yeah, I guess that is like her memory and almost like a self-preservation thing, I thought. I don't know, would you agree with that?
There's not a lot of sex to film in the movie, because that's not really a thing that happens much. I felt like we were intimate in the moments that we needed to be intimate with. I feel when watching the movie that you're really with her the whole journey, and it feels immersive to me when watching it.
Sure, yeah. What was it like working with Jacob Elordi, who plays Elvis? You know, did you guys do kind of chemistry tests beforehand? Or like, what was the, you know, did you guys hang out before you started filming? Because yeah, as you say, you've got that chemistry between the two of you, and you do get that intimacy.
I'm glad that comes across. There was talks of a chemistry read happening and then didn't happen for whatever reason. I don't know, Sophia just decided that this felt like the right casting choices with us. So the second I found out that he got the role, I emailed him. I was really excited to work with him because I was a fan of his work. But, you know, you never know what an actor is going to be like or what they're going to be willing to do. But I basically emailed him and said, you know, I'd love to meet up. I'd grab coffee or lunch or something. And he was game. And then I got kind of excited, I think. And I like planned all these things for us to do. We went horseback riding the first time we met. We went and saw a movie, an old film, Gilda, with Rita Hayworth, the first time we met. And then we just sort of bonded, and we were both in London at the same time. And we just meet up and have conversations and try to sort of understand how we were going to approach the roles and where we were coming from. And, you know, he's the real deal. He comes from a place of really just loving cinema and being such a fan of movies. And so a lot of the times we would just discuss, you know, what movies we loved and directors we thought were interesting, and, you know, our approach to coming to a role like this. And we had each other's back, and he was an actor who I felt like I could really trust and And I knew he was always going to bring a new idea to the table every scene we worked on. And he's a very generous actor. You know, I think he has more dialogue in this movie than I do. So the challenge of having to tell this story on my face in those silent moments was really interesting for me. But I needed an actor who was going to be generous in what he gave when he wasn't on camera. There's actually a surprising amount of actors who, the second that the camera turns is off of them, they sort of turn off. And he was the exact opposite of that. You know, he would give full-on performances off camera and, you know, was just really supportive and had my back. So, yeah, I really enjoyed it and I'm a fan of his.
Did you discuss, you know, the complexities of Priscilla and Elvis's relationship, which the film doesn't shy away from? I don't know, like, how did you navigate that in your performance, I guess, as an individual and then with him as well? You know, did you talk about it off camera?
I don't remember us having any sort of really in-depth conversations about the scenes, because I think we tried to stay in our mode when we were on set. And so discussing the scene sort of takes away the sort of surprise and magic, talking exactly about how we were going to play them on the day. You know, he stayed in the accent the whole time. We took it very seriously. These were very difficult, challenging roles to take on. They were very daunting. So I think the only way to do it was to do it all the way. And we both did that. I think we just tried to play the scenes as they were and try to be as truthful and honest about them. I know sometimes he'd say, you know, I just feel like we've got to go into this scene like a relationship drama. And we just have to, you know, be as true to these moments and be as human as possible. And those are the sort of the extent of the conversations we had about the scenes.
Going back to that opening scene, it's almost like a ritual of, you know, Priscilla getting ready with her hair and her makeup. Is that kind of like armor in a way, do you think, against the world?
Yeah, I think the makeup and the beauty side of it definitely tells an emotional journey as well. You know, I think that she was trying to sort of fit into this world, and, you know, she was part of this sort of American royalty. She was the queen to the king. It was part of playing a role within her own life. And then her choice to sort of be more natural and take off the makeup and come into her own, I think was really like a sort of the symbolic way of deciding to branch out outside of that and, you know, making that decision that she had something else to give in her life. And I think that the makeup and the hair and the clothing were part of her telling that story and, you know, projecting that to the world.
Yeah, for sure. There's that moment as well when like she just gone into labor and then she reaches for the false eyelashes. Like, I think that was actually in Priscilla Presley's memoir, right? Like, that actually happened.
Yeah, it's one of my favorite moments of the film because I think it says so much. And Sophia's sort of the master in saying so much in these sort of silent shots. And where she was and what she felt like she had, how she had to present and sort of the sort of ease and confidence she had in doing it, I think was just so fascinating. And that the fact that that actually happened.
And right at the start, you're applying the eyeliner wing and it's like, you know, immaculate. Did that take a few takes? You know, how long did it take to get that eyeliner?
I think we did it in one shot. I think it was
amazing.
It was a... It's one of the hardest things to shoot. I was so nervous. I didn't have a mirror or anything. And, you know, our makeup designer, she would do like the base of the eyeliner and I would do the flick every morning. So I had some practice. And then it was my moment to shine to do the eyeliner on my own. I did a little bit today. I feel pretty good about it. I think I can do a wing in my sleep now.
Yeah, no, it's serious business. I was very impressed watching that.
Thank you.
I mean, for me, I think one of the more heartbreaking moments was one of the scene with them, the photo shoot with Priscilla and Lisa Marie. Because when we think of her, I guess we think of her as being the wife and the girlfriend, but not always as the mother. So what was it like kind of playing those moments as well?
Well, I think that that was one of the key turning points in deciding that she not only wanted more for herself, but then had the responsibility of having a child and making those decisions as a mother. And, you know, this wasn't sort of a consistent enough life for her or her child and trying to figure out what the best environment for her was. And that was something that I think really sort of changed her outlook on life. And it was interesting for me trying to figure out, you know, I'm not a mother, trying to figure out, you know, what happens to you and what happens to your worldview once you bring a child into the world. But Sophia is a mother, and we have conversations about that and how it changes you as a person.
Yeah, and I know Priscilla was an executive producer on the movie, and I think I read that, you know, you spoke to her before making the film, but have you spoken to her since and, you know, kind of got her thoughts on the film?
Well, the first time I saw the movie was at Venice Film Festival. I hadn't watched the movie. I had opportunities to set up a screening, but I was just too nervous to watch it. Too weird to watch myself on screen for 2 hours. And so I hadn't done it yet. I kept putting it off. We got to go to Venice, which was amazing. And I wasn't going to watch the film again. They were going to take me out when the movie started playing. And then I turned to Sophia. I'm like, what do you think I should do? Should I watch the movie or not? And she said, I think you should take in this moment. This is a really special moment in your life. We're at Venice. You should enjoy the movie and all of our hard work. And I was like, okay, I can't say no to Sophia when she says that. But then they sat me right next to Priscilla herself. And so not only am I watching the movie for the first time and watching my face on a big screen for 2 hours, but I'm watching it with the person that I'm playing. So it was very surreal, out of body experience. It wasn't very enjoyable, I'd say. I didn't have a good time doing that, but then it was obviously very rewarding whenever we got the reception that we did once the movie finished playing. And then it was the first time that Priscilla turned to me and said, you know, that was a great performance and I watched my life through you, which was really amazing to sort of end this journey. To have that be said to me is the greatest gift and the best review I could ask for.
So there we go. That is Emily and Kaylee chatting winged eyeliner. Quite a tricky thing to do if you've ever had a go, James. You often get one right and the other just terribly not, and it's very, very frustrating. But Kaylee can do it freehand and perfectly, so well done to her. Let's talk about this film then. You and I saw this in Venice, didn't we, last year in September. It was one of the films that the stars and the director were allowed to publicise. So we did get Kaylee and Jacob Elordi, who plays Elvis, on the red carpet, and also Priscilla herself. And she's written the book that this film is based on. It's her own biography that she wrote in 1985 after Elvis had died, and it's a bit of a tell-all. What else does it get into, James? I mean, we've obviously had Baz Luhrmann's Elvis in 2022. Where does this go, and what does it offer as a different perspective?
Well, it's definitely, I like to think, I think you just said the flip side. I kind of look at it, if you look at it as a 7-inch single, this is the quieter B-side, basically. And, you know, we all know Luhrmann's film is brash and full of showmanship and swagger and sizzle. And this is very, very much a Sofia Coppola film. It's a lot quieter. It's obviously from Priscilla's perspective, looking at Elvis from a very young age, from the age of basically 14, where she's growing up on this airbase in West Germany. And that's where she first meets Elvis when he's doing his sort of mandatory kind of military service. It's their romance seen through her eyes. So there isn't really a great deal of Priscilla, you know, relatively speaking, in the Luhrmann film. You know, that's obviously from Elvis's perspective. Well, actually also from Colonel Parker's perspective, Elvis's manager, who here is largely absent, I think. So,
he's heard on the phone
once. So this is obviously from Priscilla's viewpoint. You're really getting this kind of whirlwind that she's sort of thrown into as she moves from Europe back to Graceland, to Elvis's home. And then she's kind of thrown into this kind of maelstrom of fame and watching as Elvis has to deal with being the biggest star in the universe. And what on earth that was like for him and for her. You know, it doesn't flinch at times. There, we do see some of Elvis's less than good behavior, let's call it. You have to say it is truly a Sofia Coppola film. I think from the moment you see, I think if I remember rightly, the opening shot is like a sort of pink carpet, I think, if I'm getting that right.
Oh, yes, with little feet. Little feet in very plush carpet.
With little feet, yeah. And it's that sort of tactile feel that Coppola does so well. I mean, you truly know what it feels like when the camera finally gets to Graceland. You know, she has a lot of fun depicting the kind of gaudiness, let's say, of Graceland. And I really felt like I was propelled into that universe. As I say, it's very, very different to the Elvis film, to the Baz Luhrmann film. For a start, she doesn't have the music, doesn't have the rights to Elvis's music. So that does make it a hugely different experience, but not necessarily, it doesn't necessarily impact negatively, I thought. I don't know. What did you think about the lack of Elvis music?
It's interesting, isn't it? Because this is made with the full participation of Priscilla Presley, who is an exec producer on it. But it was a film that when she knew it was happening, Lisa Marie Presley was furious about and really didn't sanction. And EPE, Elvis Presley Enterprises, who own Graceland and run all the business of Elvis and, you know, very, very sort of litigious on his patents and his image, really refused any cooperation with this film at all because they didn't feel that it was complimentary. It isn't of Elvis. So no music, no filming at Graceland, no help with costumes or any archive access, all of the things that Lerman had. But yes, I agree. I don't think you can tell. They built Graceland in Toronto and they filmed it very briskly over sort of, I think, 9 weeks. And they really get the idea of it via really fantastic production design and costume that, as you say, you can feel the sort of cashmere sweaters. You can really sort of smell the plastic of the trinkets and things that are around. It really does get that right. I think it does pull punches. And I've read the book, and in the book that was written, you know, before really Graceland was such a huge conglomerate money spinner, Priscilla is very, well, bald about what Elvis was like and what his friends were like. So I feel like because she's the exec producer, there's a softening of that story and a pulling back from it, because now her perspective of him has probably changed over the years as well from when she wrote that book. So as a sort of nerd, I found it a little bit not quite as brave as it pretends to be. Let's talk about Jacob Elordi, though. You know, there's obviously a huge amount of love for Austin Butler's performance, and he was very nominated during award season. Do we think that Elordi's going to be running around the awards circuit this year?
Well, first of all, there's probably a lot of love for Elordi because of his performance in Saltburn, which that could strangely cancel out his potential awards run for Priscilla. But I do think, given that he presumably would have seen the Lerman Elvis, or clearly obviously would be aware of it, it's quite daunting to sort of follow Butler's incredible performance and put his own spin on Elvis. And I thought he did a really, really good job, actually. I mean, there's a kind of moment early on, I think they're at a party and he's on the piano playing, and he kind of sort of sweeps his glass off or something. And I think he then catches it, as I remember. It's been a while since I've seen it, but that's how I remember it. And it was just such a sort of like moment of swagger. And I thought, oh God, he really has just nailed that feeling of Elvis as a sort of, well, not star in waiting, but, you know, this is Elvis in a private moment. And that's a lot of what Priscilla is, isn't it? It's kind of Elvis in private moments. He seemed to nail that charisma. And yeah, I really liked him in this. Putting it, you know, it's obviously, he's very much the supporting character here, obviously not the lead, unlike Butler. Yeah, I felt he really just captured that kind of snarl that Elvis has. And of course, he didn't have to do what Butler did in terms of performing the songs, really. There's a kind of little, we hear a little strain of Love Me Tender, which is about as close as we get to an Elvis song. It's only the piano strain we hear of it, not any lyrics, because that piano strain comes from another song, so they were sort of legally allowed to use it. But, you know, so he doesn't have to perform on stage in the way that Butler does, but I felt like he kind of put his own spin on that, on the essence of Elvis. How did you feel?
This is the thing as well. Like, no one knows what Elvis was like in the lounge or in the kitchen. And we obviously, there's loads of books of people telling us this stuff. But a lot of us do know what Elvis was like on stage. We've seen him in old footage. So for Butler, it has to be absolutely perfect. It has to be that you look at it and you go, that is exactly what he was like. Whereas I think Elordi has a lot more freedom to play with it. And that's what you see here. You see less of the sort of perfection of it and more the vibe of it. Who was he as a person? And, you know, in some places he's cruel, he's goofy, he's silly. He sort of looms over Priscilla like a vampire in this sort of mausoleum that they create, because, you know, they don't ever go out in the day. They only exist at night. This weird sort of world that he lived in, where he woke up at 4 and had his breakfast and then continued through the night. And that sort of wooziness, I think, is captured well. The fact that she didn't know really where she was with him. He could be incredibly loving. He could be sexy. He could be angry. He could be furious. He could be completely like ignoring her. And she didn't really know where she was with him. And I do think Elordi manages to capture that really well. Whether or not he will be in the awards running, I don't know. But she did win the big prize at Venice for her performance. So perhaps Kaylee is the one we should be talking about in this.
I think she does a really credible job. And it feels like it's going to be her year, really, with obviously this doing the rounds. And then she's in the new Alien film coming up. And I think it's Alex Garland's Civil War as well. So she's got a real slate to sort of wow people. But this is probably going to be the performance everyone will remember. It's a tough thing to pull off. Yeah, she's just kind of perfect, really, in this.
She does have, as you say, she's got this incredible job because whilst she was filming, she wasn't, obviously, as we know, films do not film in order. So in the morning, she could be 14 with a bow in her hair. And in the evening, she could be with a baby on her hip. And the next day, she would be like in 1967 doing something else. And she had to sort of toggle emotionally through that. I mean, she said to me in Venice, we talked about this film then, that she didn't really know where she was until she got the wig on. Once the hair was on, she sort of could really dial into where Priscilla was in her life. But I do think she does a great job of being that 14-year-old wide-eyed girl who then sees just this dream of hers turn to disappointment, that actually sometimes when you get the prince and the fairy tale castle, it's not as much fun as you think it's going to be. And then what do you do? And I do think she's really, really good. I do hope she is in the running this year. I'd like to see her on that circuit.
Little bit of background to filming that Elordi is obviously about 6'5" and she's about 5'1", I think. And they had to sort of place her on apple boxes and things like that when they were filming, just to sort of slightly even up their heights a little bit. I thought that was quite a sweet little detail.
Yeah, she told me she had stripper heels that she would walk whenever her feet weren't in shot, like really massive platforms. And at some point she had like a platform runway built through the lounge of Graceland so she could walk through the lounge alongside him and they didn't look too different heights. That seems like an awful lot of fuss. Couldn't he have just like squatted down a bit? I don't know. Anyway, I love the fact that these were the people that Sofia Coppola wanted to cast and therefore, just because they were different heights didn't make a difference. She was going to work around it. This was happening. So are we saying, though, that this is worth going to see? If you've loved Elvis, the Lerman, and you want more, is this going to satisfy an itch? And if you've no interest in Elvis, is this interesting?
Tough one. I think if you've loved Elvis, maybe you won't like this so much because they are very, very different films. But if you're a big Elvis fanatic, and I know you are, then you're surely going to be interested to see what Coppola has to say. And this, you know, this flip side presentation of the Elvis story. Yeah, if you've got no interest in Elvis, I don't know. Yeah, I still think people will find it interesting. Like you said earlier, perhaps it does pull its punches a little bit in places. So if you have read the book like you have, maybe you'll come out being a little disappointed. As I said, I kind of enjoyed the tactile nature of it, the sort of, you know, the Coppola-esque touches. I don't always love her films, but sometimes I think she gets things just right. And I thought she did in this, just the feel of it, the sort of, you know, late 50s, early 60s feel. I thought she evoked that really well. So as a period piece, I really enjoyed it. So, and, you know, as we were just saying, the performances are really, really good. So I think there is a lot to take out of it that you will enjoy.
Speaking of The Bodyguard, it does have I Will Always Love You, Dolly Parton's classic tune in there in a key moment that is really quite brilliant, especially if you know anything about Elvis. So I think we're saying we recommend you go off and see Priscilla this weekend at the cinema?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, so that is Priscilla. It is out in cinemas now. Right, from stardom to spookiness, it's this. Well, I'm just scared of
you. When we all fall asleep, where do we go? Kiss me. No, he didn't. When we were fixing up the pool... Stop!
They said it hadn't been used in 15 years.
Maybe they weren't pool people.
This is now for the kids.
So this is Night Swim, a Blumhouse chiller about a haunted swimming pool. But before we go for a dip, let's listen to Matt Mayton's chat with stars Wyatt Russell and Kerry Condon when he sat down with them before Christmas.
There has to be some way to stop this.
Marco.
Elliot!
Marco! 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 Marco!
To start in the most obvious place, could you introduce your characters in Night Swim and say what it was about them that sort of intrigued you to play them?
I play Ray Waller. He's an ex-baseball player who's come down with multiple sclerosis. He can't play baseball anymore. Family is looking for a more permanent place, more permanent home. They find a place with a pool, and the pool has some kind of cool magical powers that ends up turning Ray into something that he's not, or exploiting a part of his personality that he's not entirely proud of. The thing that brought me to the movie was great conceit. I love the idea. Hadn't been done before, very unique. Bryce, I believed in the movie that he wanted to make. And Jason Blum and James Wan were two, you know, proven track record with horror that they were going to know how to execute this and help support Bryce in getting the movie that he wanted on film.
And I play Eve Waller. I play Wyatt's wife in the movie. At the beginning, like, they were kind of like childhood sweethearts. We imagined that they met when they were like in high school, and that you're, you know, sure that they're love each other, but at the same time, they're at a time in their relationship where he kind of took up all the attention for a long time, and now it's kind of, she's hoping, like, he's going to retire and things are going to change, it's going to be her turn, but there's a sort of a little bit of friction between the two of them, because he's quite self-engrossed and she's, like, sacrificed a lot of her life to take care of the children. And I kind of like that idea of, like, somebody who is, like, behind an athlete who kind of, like, is the person who takes care of the family, and, like, that's a really hard, thankless job that nobody really considers is that great. But ultimately, like, she's kind of the stronger one. That really appealed to me. I liked the kind of idea that it wasn't a perfect dynamic. Then also, I kind of played with the idea that, like, she alludes to the fact that her dad was quite tough on her. You know, he pushed her in the swimming pool when she was very young, and it was like sink or swim. And then I was like, oh, so then she was a really good swimmer. She was kind of like a competitive swimmer. And I was kind of a competitive swimmer when I was younger. So I started to, like, brought those two things together to justify, well, how is she so good in the pool at the end? Like, she has to be, we have to establish she's a good swimmer early on. And so hence the swimsuit that I picked for the swimsuit scenes were quite sporty, and so I kind of, like, set up the idea that she was that kind of a person early on.
And so, Wyatt, did you have any swimming experience before this film?
Yeah, I grew up in Southern California for the most part, so you do a lot of swimming here. That's the weather. Beaches, big part of your life. I'd swam quite a bit.
And so was there kind of any special swimming training required to kind of get you ready for this film, where you are spending a fair bit of time in the pool?
And you know, it's gas. It's like, they didn't even ask if I could swim. Looking back, I'm like, that's the first thing they should ask me. But honestly, that's why I did it, because I was like, I'll shine in these moments. This will be like a great, you know, string to my bow if I can show them that I'm able to do this. But we did have to practice holding the breath a little bit. Mm. But, like, I mean, it wasn't like, you know, the whole movie was shot underwater. It wasn't like I had to practice and hold it for, like, a crazy amount of time. You know what I mean? Like, I tried my best, and I could do it for as long as was necessary for the take or whatever. It was a little bit tricky when I had Gavin, the child, and I was holding the child. I kind of had to be responsible for him. And also, he was heavy too, you know, so when I had to kind of carry him, he was like heavy. But that was the only tricky part. But not much training, no. No, they would give you like a float in between takes to kind of hang on to and relax. But remember, I was like, I don't even want the float. I was like, I got it.
I took the float.
Yeah, he did take the float. I was like, oh.
So it wasn't competitive then between you. I thought you might be trying to outdo each other for, like, who could hold their breath the longest and things like that.
Carrie can win on all.
I'm not
of those.
That kind of competitive. Yeah, no, I'm not that. Not that like that, really. No, and their characters were different, you know, so the dynamic wasn't really like that. It was more, yeah, no, I'm not that silly.
Do they keep the water warm for you?
Yes.
They did for him, because he kept complaining about it.
Yeah. I love how you, there's so many times where it was like a perfect 95. And then Carrie's not complaining.
It was unhygienic.
It had to be warm. I was like, it was you were going to be in there for too long. I loved it. It was perfect.
I didn't like it. It was very aging on the skin when it's too warm, to be honest. And then he was sick for a lot of it too, so he was coughing up phlegm. And I was like, if you spit it in the pool, I'll kill you. So it had little challenges.
Yeah, I did not spit in the pool. Let me just set the record.
Good.
I never did that. I peed in the pool.
But did
I didn't spit in the pool. No, of course not. Well, maybe I did.
I probably did.
Why is you didn't? Or that's terrible.
There was a lot of times where I was in the pool by myself. Okay, you know, it's like, I'm up here right now. Nobody's in here. It's me.
Move on. Next question.
How many times did you pee in the pool?
There's this really believable chemistry between you guys together in the film, and also like your on-screen children as well. Is that part of the casting process? Do you do any chemistry reads or screen tests, or do they just kind of pick you and throw you together and hope that it works?
I think that was Bryce, to be honest, picking the children. Yeah, he did a really good job with that because they were older than they were playing. So actually, Amelie, who played my daughter, was really mature for her age. She was kind of like she was our age, yeah, like talking to her. She seemed very mature. So I loved that dynamic between the two of them, the way they kind of, she kind of grows up in the movie in many ways, and they kind of become like, she understands her mother a lot more by the end of the movie. And yeah, I guess it was easy because we were all stuck in the same location, and there was only kind of a cast of such a small cast, so it's kind of easy to
get to know
everyone. Yeah.
Are you guys horror buffs yourself? Is it do you watch a lot of horror movies?
I have watched a lot of horror movies. I've Suspiria is a big one. Was a big one in our house. Evil Dead 2. We made horror films when I was like 12, 10. I was always the kid who was. I like made the joke of like getting mauled by the dog or whatever horror device that they wanted to eat. My brother and John wanted to use to make something bad happen to me. I did grow up with it and an appreciation for it, because the great thing about horror is that you can just do everything. Like all the special effects, all the practical effects. It really is like movie making at its most. It's just fun to be a part of it. It's fun. It's always fun to go back to it if the idea is good and the actors are good. It can be a really great experience.
I would say no, I'm not a horror fan. But then, like, as an actress, I don't necessarily have to be in movies that I'd watch either. Like, acting them is different to watching them. There's quite a lot of things I've acted in that I personally, you know, wouldn't be my taste. But I loved the role and being a part of it and learning different jobs and stuff. I mean, if you only acted in movies you watched, Jesus, like your career would be very limited. But I do like thriller. Like when I think of, when you say horror, like it's such a big range. Because I think of horror and I think of like, you know, Freddy Krueger and stuff like that. And I'm like, no, I don't want to scare the shit out of myself. Like I don't really enjoy that. But I do love thriller movies. And I think this kind of was more in that vein. And it sort of reminded me of those 90s movies. Thriller. As opposed to gory and bloody and just downright like scary for the sake of it, sort of. So that'd be more me.
Just a very quick final question. You've both got some really exciting stuff coming up. So in like 30 seconds, could you, Wyatt, kind of tease what we can expect from Thunderbolts? And Kerry, you've got Skeleton Crew and Joseph Kaczynski's Formula One film. So we're kind of hugely excited about all those.
Thunderbolts is going to be fun as we start relatively soon. The cast is amazing. The director is a great friend and an incredible director, and I think it has a lot of positive stuff going for it. So I'm very excited.
And Skeleton Crew, I filmed before I filmed this one, and it was probably one of the most fun jobs that I've been on. And working with minors, you would think it would actually be quite tricky, but it was the most pleasant, like sweet experience to work on. So I hope that sort of translates when people see it. I loved the scripts and I loved the four leads. And then the Joseph Kaczynski one, where we only started that a little bit before the strike. So we go back filming that. And I'm really excited about that and learning all about Formula One. And it kind of seems a bit like gambling. Time and out tires and time and races and all. It's a bit like going to Vegas and gambling. Yeah, there's kind of a similarity. So I'm really enjoying learning all about that.
That was Wyatt Russell and Kerry Condon talking about Night Swim. James, you've trotted off to see this. I haven't. Just give us a little bit of a taste of what actually goes on in this, in terms of if we haven't known. We know it's a haunted swimming pool. Anything else we should know about this film before you get stuck into whether you liked it?
Well, is it a haunted swimming pool or is it a pool that helps people? That's a line that is used at one point. So we know that Wyatt, of course, plays Ray Waller. He's a sort of ex-baseball player who's left the game simply because of a kind of unspecified in the film illness. But pretty serious. They mentioned white blood cells. He's limping around. He's having to take time off the sport to make some recovery. So at the very beginning of the film, he and his wife, Eve, played by Kerry Condon, of course, and their two kids, Izzy and Elliot, they're looking for a place to live. They might rent a place. And then they come across this place to buy. It has a big swimming pool, an outdoor one, which is ideal because he's been told to get some water therapy as part of his rehabilitation, his recovery. He should be warned because within about 2 minutes of scouting the property, he's fallen in the pool for some strange reason. It's almost like something has sucked him into it. But they take the house anyway. They think it'll be ideal for his recovery. And then miraculously, he does start to recover rather well. Now, is there something in the water that's helping him? Or is it haunted? Right at the beginning, there's a little prologue where we see a young girl who's in that pool 2 decades before, and something happens to her, no spoilers. So we know something's amiss. The problem is with the film, it never really answers the question of what is wrong with the pool. It seems to have multiple ideas, this idea of healing, this idea of being haunted, of something being trapped there. I won't go into too much detail for people that will go and see it as to what they find in the pool. It's constantly belching out black kind of liquid. There's sort of apparitions that people seem to think they've seen something and then haven't. There are possible boogeymen floating around, let's say. It's like there's lots and lots of ideas that this could be, and none of them really make any logical sense. Now, obviously, this is a horror film. It's not meant to make actual logical sense, but within the sort of dream logic of the film, there is no real sense. It's like it doesn't really know what it wants to be. And this is actually based on a 2014 short by Bryce McGuire, who is the co-writer and director here. So they've obviously expanded this idea of a kind of haunted pool into a sort of fully-fledged feature, but they don't really know what they're doing with it, unfortunately. I mean,
James Wan is involved. He knows what he's doing with horror. What's going on here then?
James Wan and Jason Blum. It's a Blumhouse film. I think they just thought, well, one location primarily. It was either that or the baseball pitch where there's a few sort of scenes around the kind of Little League baseball. Yeah, you know, it's a cheap one to make, obviously, relatively speaking, which is what the Blumhouse model is based on.
Yeah.
But it's just not scary. I mean, it's not even vaguely scary. There's just no scenes of tension. I mean, you know, looking around me at the screening, I didn't see anyone jump or make any kind of, you know, noise of, you know, it was just sort of, I think, apathy, really. We were sort of lulled into a kind of, oh, God, really? It was just one of those horror films you think, that's not even going to work when you're drunk on a Friday night, basically.
They could put that on the bus then. Won't even work if you're drunk on a Friday night. James Mottram, total film. So in terms of star ratings, what are we giving this, James? You are reviewing it for us.
I am reviewing it, and I'm wavering between a 1 and a 2, really. I mean, a 1 should really be reserved for something that's so wretched. You know, you'd be storming the barricades, demanding your money back. And it might not be quite that bad. It's reasonably well made. There's lots of nice shots underneath the water of people's legs and things, you know, to try and build up atmosphere. There's no real, as I said earlier, no real sort of logic in the story. Yeah, it's a film about sacrifice without going into too much detail. That's its kind of theme. But it doesn't really work as a theme, or it doesn't really have enough sacrifice that emotionally drags you in. I mean, of course, there's teenagers in the water. We have that one. We have that little, you know, both the kids have
horror tropes of the teenagers.
Both the kids, Izzy is a little older than her brother, but both of them have incidents in the pool where they think something's happened. But in the end, there wasn't really enough jeopardy in it. That was my big problem with it. It's like, you know, I mean, we watched the Thanksgiving, didn't we, a few weeks ago. That's obviously a very different tone in terms of a horror film. But my God, there was some jeopardy going on in that film. You know, people get offed left, right and center.
Yes. And here, and got off as well.
There just isn't that kind of jeopardy. And it was really sort of lame and disappointing for that reason. It's trying to build up, it's trying to be atmospheric. And of course, you know, a creepy outdoor pool in the dark should be atmospheric, but there just wasn't enough there.
So you'll be going back into the water then. You're not bothered.
No, not bothered at all, I have to say.
Oh, dear. I'm disappointed to hear this, considering the lovely Kerry Condon, isn't it? And she was so sensational in The Banshees of Inisherin, and now she's come to this. How is she?
She's fine. And so is Wyatt Russell, for that matter, although he has more of the heavy lifting to do, you could say, than she does. But you know, they make a credible family. They have some nice sort of banter early on when they decide to buy the house, and he sort of, they're in the hospital actually, where he's just been sort of assessed for his condition. And then he kind of sort of cheekily says to her, oh, do you still have that black bikini? And, you know, it's quite cute little building up of their chemistry. But it's not really their fault, nor the youngsters that play the children. It's just what they have to work with. There just isn't there enough there for a feature. You know, obviously made a great short, enough to sort of inspire, you know, the Blumhouse team and James Wan, et cetera, to go, well, there could be a film here. And, you know, it will still probably do pretty well. That's my guess. But I remember last year at this time, I saw Megan. I think that was one of my first screenings last year. And how good was that?
Yeah.
And, you know, and a real surprise. And this is just not that, unfortunately. I really wish it was. But, yeah, it was a bit of a lame duck to start the new year with.
Okay. So it didn't go with a splash. Not gone swimmingly. Is not going to be floating anyone's boat here.
Any more pool puns you can
I mean, those are off the top of my head, but, you know, if you've got any more, throw them in. But basically we're saying treat with caution. Go and see this if you love horror and you really want to be a completist, but otherwise maybe wait for it on a streaming platform.
I think that's a perfect way of putting it.
Night Swim is in cinemas from Friday. Right, want to jump on a plane for a flight over the mountains? You might not want to after this.
Sabemos dónde estamos.
Mírame los ojos. Mírame los ojos. ¡Mira!
El avión no se ve.
¿Y aunque pasen por encima nuestro, no van a ver?
¿Qué pasa cuando el mundo te abandona?
¡Ayuda!
Cuando no tenés ropa y te estás congelando.
¡Dónde llegar hasta arriba!
Cuando no tenés comida y te estás muriendo.
This is Society of Snow, the true story of the Uruguayan rugby team who crashed in the Andes in 1972 and spent 72 days in the snow. And it's directed by J.A. Bayona. Before we talk about this one, James, shall we listen to my chat with Bayona as we discuss the technicalities of creating history in an inhospitable place?
Hay que intentarlo.
I wanted to ask you about, you read obviously Pablo's book when you were making The Impossible, and both scenarios are about triumph of ordinary people in extraordinary circumstances. What appeals to you about those kind of stories?
I was so moved by Pablo's book, and I thought I knew the story, but that gave me a whole new perspective. It's been a whole journey to understand at the very end that what I was more attracted was not the fact, not the action, but the spiritual layer, the philosophical layer of the book. That was the guiding light working in the story with the actors. And then when I see the film now, I realize that the way that we achieved that spiritual layer was to tell the story through Numa's eyes. And actually what we were looking for is to give the chance the survivors basically to say thank you to all of those people who stay in the mountain. I think that's why the film is so intense but beautiful at the same time, because that's exactly the journey that they had in the mountain. This story always has been focused in the fact, and when you focus in the fact, you get into the cannibalism and the more sensationalist elements that they did in the mountain. And for us, it was more to focus in more in the human aspect of the story. Actually, there is a moment when Numa talks to Javier Metol, who is the oldest of the people in the plane, and they talk about the lack of meaning of reality. You know, when he refers to the death of his wife, the idea there is no meaning. You is the answer. So it's your interpretation, which basically is that's exactly what we do when we do a film. We take a true story. The idea is try to get as close as possible to reality, and from there try to understand what happened. And I remember having conversations with the other writers. They sometimes try to change the fact in order to make it more interesting. And I was like, I don't want the story to be more interesting. Actually, it's pretty interesting, you know. So why don't we do the exercise of trying to understand why they did what they did and why?
What they did is really important and epic, but also the fact that this film really shows the physical things that happened. The plane crash is visceral, it's horrifying, it's incredible. The avalanche is also the same. Talk me through creating those scenes, because they're astonishing pieces of filmmaking.
Yeah, it's always the same methodology, shot by shot. You know, it's like, it's when it's such a massive endeavor when you do something like that, it's just like trying to figure out how you do it shot by shot. And the other thing is how to make it for real. People ask me, how were you able to communicate feelings like cold, hungry, you know, like hunger, you know? It's the actors who do that. But by doing so, you really need to allow them to experience a similar emotion. And what we were doing is providing them the context, which means no blue screen, real snow. So those scenes, they felt very real for them, especially the avalanche. The avalanche was the hardest scenes for the actors. They had to stay in this tiny set that was like half the space already of a small set, because the fuselage was a very small set. When the snow got into the plane, it was reduced by half. So it was half of the small set that we had. And then they were under this platform that was so tiny, waiting in the dark under this wood platform with holes. These holes were prepared for them to get out. And there was like a layer of real snow that was melting all the time. So they were totally wet. It was super demanding for them. And we had this choreography where they knew what was the hole they had to come out. We had these numbers, number one, number two, number three, number four. And basically after doing interviews with the survivors, we knew who came first and who helped who, you know? So it was like a whole choreography, very long takes, because I didn't want to lose the lose the energy. It was real. I mean, they had to come up, pop up to the surface, help each other, feeling their, like despair and the cold, you know? So I remember every time I say cut, like this massive lot of people coming with hot towels, you know, in order to help them because they were freezing, you know? Yeah. So it was real, actually. And you can see that in the scene. The plane crash was more fun because for them, it was physically demanding because some of them were hanging from wires, you know. But it was a lot of fun because that was at the very end of the shoot, and which was very good because when we did those scenes where they are getting into the plane, you can really feel the chemistry, you can feel their friendship because they've been through 110 days together shooting. So you can tell that they're real friends, you know. They're not pretending, you know. So you see the real friendship. And then we got them into this thing, this massive set over a gimbal that was moving. So they felt like they were in a fairground attraction, you know. They had the time of their lives doing that. One thing that was very interesting from that scene, when I sat down with the survivors, all of them had a different memory of what happened. One of them will tell me it was like a big air bump. Another one with him, no, actually there was no bump. So it was because Pablo is a journalist. He came with this idea that he said, okay, if three people were in the room, were in that scene, and the three of them tells you the same thing, that's what happened. And from there, stay with the characters, try to know exactly what they knew. And the last thing is that in those interviews, they told me that the worst moment was not the moment that the plane crashed against the mountain, but the sliding in the snow when the plane crashed in the snow. Because that's the moment when the seats, like, moved forward, trapping the people as if they were inside this accordion. For all of them, that was the worst moment, and we put a lot of effort in trying to make it look, like, very physical for the audience.
I wanted to ask about sort of visiting the real place. You went to the real place, and obviously you did the photography of it in order to inform when you're filming in the Sierra Nevada. What was that like to actually step into the real place and sort of experience it as somebody who hasn't been through the experience but knows so much about it?
It puts you in the context. It's so different when you are there, and it's a moment that you understand how epic is what they went through. It took me 3 days to get there because you need to get used to the altitude. Because of scheduling problems, we had very little time for the pre-production. So instead of being 3 days, it was two. The biggest impact to me was to be in this massive place, this huge amphitheater of mountains, endless mountains. And you don't hear a single thing. It's the only thing that you can hear there is yourself, because there's nothing alive, you know? So when you are in that place, then is the moment that you understand how epic is what they went through. Before getting into the shooting in Spain, in Sierra Nevada, I wanted to be there. And that was an early stage of the production. We went with a group of professional climbers who are used to shoot in these conditions. And we were there for 20 days shooting all the backgrounds, because all the backgrounds that had to be replaced later on, because we were shooting in Spain and the mountains are 10 times smaller. So we knew that There was a lot of set extensions. Actually, there is 1,000 shots of set extensions in the film. But we wanted to do the set extensions with real footage. We didn't want to get into the CGI world, because being a true story, sometimes when you get into CGI, you can get very good results, but the mood, the atmosphere changes, you know? It doesn't feel as real as we were looking for. So that first journey that we did there was for 20 days. But then I went back at the end of the shoot, because that year that we shot for 20 days, there was very, very little snow. It was a very bad year for snow. I mean, the backgrounds were not that good. So we had to go back 1 year after, once we had shot the film. And I thought that it would be very interesting to get shots with actors, so you can intercut shots in Sierra Nevada with visual effects, with real shots with the actors in the mountain. So if the audience see the actor in there, they will believe the whole film, you know? So we shot the last trek, the last journey from Roberto and Nando, exactly in the same places where the story happened. But I also took Enzo with me, and we shot in the Valley of the Tears, where the plane crashed. And we spent a couple of days shooting shots with him there. I had to cheat the other producers and do it secretly, because they were not allowing me to bring the actor there. I talked to the professional climbers there, and they told me, well, I mean, if it's very specific what we do, we can try. But actually, it's a dangerous place, because there is this helicopter shot where the camera is coming from the valley. You see like an epic shot. You see where the plane is, and then it's focusing very, very slow, very slowly into Numa. And you see him, that he's looking for food. And you can see that it's Enzo in the real place. And the day after, in the exact position where he was, there was an avalanche. Pilot from the helicopter sent me a video telling me, you were there yesterday. So it's actually not a safe place. So that's why they were so concerned, the producers were so concerned. But we were very specific. We weren't there with Enzo to shoot like very specific shots that we intercut with the other shots of the film. And that makes the whole result a lot better.
So that was me chatting to J.A. Bayona and the sort of things that he put his cast through to achieve authenticity. You also talked to the cast, James, in Venice for Total Film. It is a story that we've seen before, isn't it? Alive came out a while ago, and that was a sort of Americanized version. This is Spanish language, and this is very, very much created with the survivors' families and in a very sort of careful and respectful fashion. Does that work? Does that improve upon Alive for you?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Alive was 30 years ago. As you said, it was a while ago. So time has passed, and it does feel like it's a story that could be retold. But I know that Bayona obviously wanted to do it in Spanish. He's obviously made films in English, the Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom, for example, and The Impossible, the tsunami film, which of course is another disaster movie. So he's got a track record in, first of all, he's got a track record in disaster films, and he can make films in English, but I think he was completely right to do this in Spanish. It's based on the book by Pablo Vierchi, I think it's pronounced, who was a friend of this Uruguayan rugby team that crash landed in the Andes. So he was one of their sort of contemporaries. He wasn't caught up in that disaster, but you know, he knew them all, and he was there from the very beginning in terms of being able to catalogue what happened. So already they've gone to the right source, if you see what I mean, to tell this story. And it feels completely authentic, about as authentic as it could be to recreate this story. And as you said a minute ago, very respectful, quite spiritual as a film as well. Just brilliantly conceived. I mean, I've seen some good airline crashes on movies, particularly as effects have got better. You see some, you know, incredible moments where planes are sort of ripped apart and so on and so forth. But this was one of the most terrifying crashes, yes, I think I've ever seen on screen. And not just the plane itself being kind of pulled apart, but then what happens is it crash lands and people's limbs buckling and all that kind of stuff. I mean, oh God, terrifying to watch. I have to add that after I saw this film, maybe a month or so later, a couple of months later, I actually flew to Chile on holiday, so flew over the Andes and couldn't help but think of that moment.
Yes, were you
while in the aeroplane?
Any clank and sort of thud, were you sort of worried what was going to happen? Had you packed like some tuna in your luggage just in case?
Well, I should have. But yeah, they even, of course, announced it because this plane had one of these kind of tinted windows that were dark until they could remove the tint, as it were. They pressed a button and then you could suddenly see outside, just so you could look at the terrifying Andes as you were flying over them. But luckily, it was a very smooth flight and very well handled by Latin American Airways. So I should just point that out. They did a very good job to get me safely into Santiago. But yeah, nonetheless, it does make you think as you're looking at this incredible mountain range, what happened? You know, these one of the crazy things about this story is, as I think Bayona pointed out to me, these guys, obviously coming from Uruguay, they'd never even really seen snow or mountains before. Yeah. They're all young, of course. They're, you know, it's young rugby team. And to suddenly be smashed down into this inhospitable mountain range is just a crazy, crazy thought. I remember we talked about this before after we'd seen it and how we would have both buckled in about 20 seconds if we'd been left on a mountain range with obviously minimal food, injuries and God knows what else, howling winds and much, much worse. And Bayona sort of captures it really, really well without any sort of hysteria, let's say. I mean, there's enough hysteria to go around, but it's just sort of perfectly crafted as a piece of filmmaking. I mean, I've seen people say it's the best thing he's done, you know, and that, again, that, as I said, includes the Jurassic film. He did the Lord of the Rings Amazon series, or the first series of that. You know, he's done a lot of big scale films, but I kind of think it probably is the best thing he's done. It's just sort of perfect mix of disaster film, but also character story as well. Although you can't get to know every person that's a survivor on that flight, who then has to live through these 72 days. He focuses very cleverly on a certain number of people. And we have a narrator, Nando, played by Augustin Padella, who is the guy that sort of guides us through this terrible incident that they're all having to live through. And so, you know, you do grow closer to these characters as the story goes on. It's got a documentary feel as well on some level. And I really liked that the way that, you know, that we are guided through these horrifying days. And it's just an incredible sort of, well, the story is an incredible feat of survival, of humanity. And yeah, I think the film really, really captures that very well.
You mentioned this sort of spirituality, which I think is really interesting, that you would go through a torrent of emotions, of hope, of loss, of, you know, just desolation, of thinking, well, all is lost and what do I do now? And is there a God, and should I believe in them, and should I pray, and all of that sort of stuff. And that's sort of handled as part of this as well, and the sort of emotional challenges of this, as well as the physical. Obviously, they're all getting thinner and thinner and weaker and weaker, but spiritually, this is also happening as well. And it's not done in any kind of Bible bashing way or anything like that. It's purely sort of asking audiences, how would you cope with this? What would be your strength in this moment? And especially when no spoilers, but plane crash is a terrible thing to happen in the first place. And then the loss of life that happens after that, other things happen to them that you would think, I just can't take anything else. And other things do keep happening. It really does put you in a place of where it could be a film that is deeply depressing. And yet there's something truly beautiful about the human spirit that he shows here, and you leave weirdly thinking about the hope of the film and the triumph of it rather than all of the horror that you've watched. And I think that's a really deft trick to pull in cinema.
It's a film about courage, I suppose, more than anything else, and you are left just marveling at how these people survived and what they went through. And as you say, yeah, it encapsulates the sort of hopefulness of the human spirit. And yeah, it really is a tough film to watch. You know, you're going to be wincing at times. I mean, can we mention the black pea?
Oh, yes. I mean, that's a detail I didn't know. But apparently when you're very hungry and starved of water, your pea turns black. Grim. Yeah,
and that was it's a small moment, but it's moments like that that really stick in your mind as to kind of with their bodies just giving up on them, understandably, because they're completely malnourished. And just that alone would probably make me curl up in a little ball and, you know, want it all to end. So, God knows how these people survived. And it shows why this story is, because this obviously happened in 1972, in October 72. And it's over 50 years now that we're still talking about this story. And it still merits being told, I think, or retold. So, yeah, it's I think Bayona did a fantastic job, as you say, of kind of balancing the horror and the hope. And, yeah, it's you know, he's well known for doing horror in the past in different ways. But, again, I think this time he's really got the character element right of the story, the kind of, I suppose, the uplifting nature of what is also a very difficult film to watch. It's, as you say, it's a really hard balancing act to pull off, but he really did it.
Yeah. Without being mawkish or maudlin or judgy or any of the other things, because obviously we must mention that there is an element of survival here that is something that people might struggle with. And it's probably the most famous part of this story, in that acts of cannibalism had to happen in order to survive. And there were also moments where friends, knowing that they were on their way out, gave permission to their other friends for those acts. And that could be really luridly told and grimly told. But even that, there's a sort of communion about it and a beauty in it. And the struggle that each of the characters has about it is something that I just think is just brilliantly done. And also, you know, the fact that, you know, they didn't take them to the Andes and put their cast there, but they did take them to a very horrible mountain range in Spain. I mean, beautiful if you're skiing, but not if you're standing in a jumper in the middle of it in your 70s sunglasses. And they really did sort of put them through it. They were frozen. They were, you know, out there for hours. They had to climb in and out of the area that they were filming. And then they did take them to the Andes. And so the moments, no spoilers, but there is a moment when they finally communicate with somebody, and it's in the exact spot that actually happened. And that gives it a real power as well, I think.
Yeah. Can you imagine what it must be like for all of them to go to the Andes and film as well? I mean, it would be mind-blowing, really. And yeah, I think Bayona was sort of himself up in helicopters, you know, shooting sort of incredible aerial shots and being buffeted by the winds. And that must have been a pretty terrifying experience for him. But and his crew, of course, as well. So yeah, fair play to him for, you know, not trying to recreate it with CGI, but really trying to nail that authenticity. And again, I think you feel it in the film that as much as they could, they recreated this experience.
Yes, indeed. Okay, so I think we're saying we highly recommend this one.
Yes, definitely. I mean, it's on Netflix, but I think it's in cinemas as well still. So I would say see it if you can, see it on the big screen, because you know, you'll get the full force of it.
Yes, and if you got a cinema that had really, really ferocious air conditioning, that might help. But yes, if you don't want to go out and see it, it is on Netflix from today. Time for more real life heroism now with this.
Now, an extraordinary story about a young man who many years ago visited Prague. What he found there were thousands of refugees at the mercy of Hitler's imminent invasion.
Do you ever think about the children and what happened to them?
I bet you got some stories.
That's really not about me.
We are working to evacuate these children by train to safety in Britain.
Why are you doing this, Mr. Winton?
Because I may be able to do something about it. I must.
So this is One Life. And James, this took me back to my childhood. This, you know, ages me, because I can recall this story happening on That's Life, the popular BBC show that was hosted by Esther Ranson and various others, where this elderly man was brought on and he was given a surprise by the people in the audience. Not to spoil what happened there, but if you're aware of that particular story, then this might not come as such a surprise. But tell us, who is this about? What is The One Life at the core of this film?
Well, I have to say, I'm also old enough to remember That's Life, and I don't actually remember this story. I'm not quite sure how it passed me by, because I'm sure I would have been aware of it. I know. Perhaps I was away that week. Who knows? So it was a surprise to me, this film. So at the core of it, it's about a person called Nicholas Winton, a British former stockbroker who, in just before the outbreak of World War II, was sort of called to Czechoslovakia, where he discovered, with everyone aware that Hitler and was amassing troops and so forth, Winton decided he wanted to get young children out of Czechoslovakia on trains, kinder transports, as they're called, to Britain, which involved not only organising the transport, but organising visas, speaking to members of the British government, or finding foster families for these children. An incredible amount of work, which he didn't do on his own. He had help back in Britain from his mother and then a team of people in the Czech Republic, or the Czechoslovakia. But, you know, he sort of masterminded this incredible operation. So the film is partly about that. And at that point, Winton is played by Johnny Flynn. And it's also about 50 or so years later, where he is obviously an older man, and at this point played by Sir Anthony Hopkins, and how his incredible deeds came to light, partly via the That's Life show. So it's a kind of yo-yo sort of script that keeps going back and forth between these two sets of events, and it kind of builds up from there.
Is one of those more successful than the other? Because it was for me.
Well, it's often when you have these kind of flip-flop stories, you're often like thinking, oh, I really want to get back to X narrative because I'm really enjoying that. Yeah, that's a very good question. I hadn't actually thought about it in that way. I enjoy both parts because you do need one and the other. But strangely, I suppose perhaps because it was Anthony Hopkins in the segment when Nicholas Winton is older, I was kind of more drawn to that. I was quite intrigued by how this old man had hidden away these incredible deeds that he'd done, and yet was still haunted by a lot of what he did or did not achieve, not through any fault of his own. So, and I quite liked watching how that unfolded as a storyline. The pre-World War II segment is perfectly well done. I feel like I'd sort of seen that before, but it was nicely done. I think Johnny Flynn was very good. You've got Helena Bonham Carter playing his mother. You've got Roma Legare turns up as one of the quite a spiky woman who helps them in the Czechoslovakia. So it's nicely cast, but I think I was more compelled overall to watch the Hopkins segment.
Agreed. Yeah, I found the war sections very rote. I felt like I'd seen them all before, and I felt that even camera angles and the way that it was edited and the pacing of it felt designed to elicit emotion, which I understand that is the point of the film, but in a way that I felt I didn't enjoy it. I didn't like it very much. And I didn't feel like Johnny Flynn was anything like Anthony Hopkins or vice versa. Perhaps that's the point, it doesn't matter. But I did really like Hopkins. I do think he's just great to watch, and his real sadness, and as you say, this hauntedness that he had from managing to save some children, but not, from his point of view, managing to save enough. And then this not knowing whatever happened to those children. He brought them from, you know, a place of real danger to London and literally handed them over to strangers, people who came forward and said, yes, we'll take a child or we'll take two children. And they gave them away to people. And then the war, you know, furled across Europe. And, you know, nobody kept track of who anyone went with and who, well, I mean, they just didn't know what happened to those children. And so I really liked that idea of him constantly wondering, and that his life had almost stopped at that point, that he'd taken the last children off the train and he couldn't get beyond it really without knowing that. So that then when you do get the big emotional moment that we won't say what it is, but you probably know if you do remember the show, it really packs a punch because he suddenly is aware of what's happened and the impact he's made in this entire sort of terrible period of the history. So yeah, I blubbed like a baby at that bit.
Yeah, I have to say I did too. And I actually saw the film for a second time, obviously by this point knowing exactly what was going to happen, and blubbed again. So yes. You have to say that scene that you're referring to clearly works. And in a way, that's what it's obviously building towards. There was a piece in a newspaper by, I think it was a son of one of the children that Winton saved, who was invited to the premiere, but was quite critical of the film in some senses and thought it was quite sentimental. For example, at a certain point, we see Winton kind of crying and in sort of in tears and quite emotional. And a lot of people were like, well, in reality, he wasn't like that. And that the operation to rescue these children, he almost treated it like a business on some level, you know, because that was the mentality he came from. It wasn't that he was necessarily cold. That was how he functioned. I mean, you know, if you can imagine what it took to ship out 669 children, you would have to treat it like a sort of, well, almost like a military operation, really.
Yes.
But the film does go for a sentimental telling, yes, of this story, you could say. But, you know, it does get you in the throat by the end, as it clearly did for both of us. So
yes,
there's a lot of Holocaust stories around at the moment. We've got soon to be out the Jonathan Glazer, The Zone of Interest, yes, film, which is the polar opposite to One,
yes,
Life,
very
in the
much
way
so
it approaches the story. You know, it's such a vast subject and there's different ways of telling them. But yeah, I think if you're perhaps more middle of the road in your film tastes, you will probably enjoy One Life.
Yes. I mean, I think you just have to be aware that it probably is mawkish until it gets to a point where it manages to transcend that for real emotion for me. So I sort of warily suggest you go and see it. I do think that Hopkins is sensational. He always is, and very much worth watching. And I loved the sort of 80s, the sort of era that we were living in that second half of the film. But yeah, I think the flashbacks have problems. But if you get your tears going at the end, maybe that's all that matters. And if it puts that story out there that, you know, in any situation, you know, like the Society of Snow, it's the spirit of humans, isn't it, that just manages to get through terrible times. And that's something to celebrate. Let's say we will cautiously recommend then, James?
Yes, cautiously, I'd say.
Cautiously recommending then, One Life, which is out in cinemas on Friday. Right, that is our lot for this week. Which of these films is your film of the week?
I am going for Society of the Snow. I think that's just a fantastic piece of filmmaking. And I hope he gets, you know, a bit of love in the award season. It's difficult to know at the moment because there's a lot of other great stuff around. But yeah, I really recommend anyone watching this.
Yeah, I'm going to say Priscilla, purely because, as you know, I can't resist an Elvis item. And I do think it's a sort of cultural, interesting film. And you know, it does use Dolly's song rather well. OK, so a reminder then, if you like this podcast, you can make your life easier just by subscribing to it. And then you don't have to look for it, you know, try and find where it is. It's there ready for you. Also, we should say there's a new issue out today. It's Godzilla X Kong, Godzilla Times Kong, Godzilla Kiss Kong. I don't even know how we're saying this, James.
I'm calling it Godzilla X Kong colon the new empire. So
there we go. You're using all of your grammar.
That is Mr. Graham, isn't it, doing the Godzilla X-Kong.
This issue is actually the Jamie Graham and Jane Crowther issue because he did Godzilla and Kong. He also talked to Matthew Vaughan and all of his cast about Argyle. And I did Masters of the Air with all of the lads from that. And The Boys in the Boat, where I hung out with George Clooney and Callum Turner. And George showed me videos of Brad Pitt messing around on the set of his latest film. And I also did Willem Dafoe as the Total Film interview. So I had a really fantastic time on this issue. I highly recommend going out and buying it because there's lots of good stuff, including Kung Fu Panda 4. Which, if you're not anticipating and waiting that with bated breath, I don't know what's wrong with you. It sounds like it's going to be awesome. It's out now with Godzilla X Kong colon the new empire. Right, that's it. Before we go, though, it's time for a listener's question, James. Oh, dear. This is somebody who's depressed at being back at work and not happy about it. What's the best depressing office scenes in a movie?
I don't know if it's depressing, but I always really enjoy in being John Malkovich, where he goes to the office there and it's on the 7th and a half floor, which is a very bizarre Charlie Kaufman idea. So I wouldn't call it depressing, but I love that. Then I guess it's not a movie, but you could look at Severance as well, the Apple TV show.
There is a movie called Severance about offices, though. Danny Dyer.
That's true, yes. The strangest workplace you'll ever go into in that Apple show. So I'd go with that one. What about you?
It's got to be Office Space, hasn't it? I think we've all worked for a Bill Lumberg who comes hovering over to your desk just at the sort of an hour before you're finished and goes, yeah, I'm going to need you to go ahead and come in tomorrow. And you're just like, I hate you so much. But the thing I relate to the most in depressingness in offices is the printer that will not work. Why has no one invented a printer that works, like that just works? I have a printer at home. It doesn't work. It loads paper wrong. It always needs a cartridge at the wrong time. It beeps. It does things. It flashes numbers that tells me things are off. I don't know why printers don't work, and it doesn't work in office space, and they take a baseball bat to it. And that's frankly what I'd like to do with most printers.
Wow. I have to say, I used to have a printer like that a long time ago, which was terrible and was very annoying. And then I bought the one I've got, still got now, which has lasted forever and has just been absolutely brilliant. So I just want to big up that.
Oh,
I'm not
well
going to mention the brand, but
well done, little printer, yeah, over in the Mottram household.
Yeah, yes, I'm very happy with my printer, but it's very annoying. You know, you'd think it's such a simple thing, and when they don't work, it's like, yeah, you're bashing your head against the wall.
Yeah, and and as they say in that, what is PC load letter? It doesn't make sense what you're asking me. So that would be mine. Okay. So on that note, I think we're going to skip along into our offices tomorrow. I'm sure we will, despite the weather, despite the post-Christmas slump. And write some more stuff about movies. On that note, James, I think we should say goodbye. So say goodbye and do it in your most lively fashion, please.
Bye.
Oh, that was cheery. Goodbye.
Tumble out of bed and I stumble to the kitchen. Pour myself a cup of ambition and yawn and stretch and try to come to life. Jump in the shower and the blood starts pumping. Out on the streets the traffic starts jumping. With folks like me on the job from 9 to 5. Working 9 to 5. What a way to make a living. Barely getting by. It's all taking and no giving. They just use your mind. Service and devotion.